It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we're doing that today via Zoom once again. We are talking about the art and science of mathematics in dance, and how dance notation occurs, writing on paper of movement, as well as how important the counts are for a dancer and with the music. Mark, this is going to be a fascinating conversation, and we have a great collection of guests for it. Introduce them.
We do. I'm excited to introduce Julia Arciero, and she's professor of mathematics at IUPUI. Hi, Julia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome. Yeah.
And Cynthia Pratt, who's a dance professor at Butler University.
Hi, Cynthia. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Cynthia. Good to have you.
Yes.
And we've got musician, composer, and educator at IUPUI, Robin Cox. Hi, Robin.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Robin, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. So I was thinking about how in the world, Cynthia, you would ever record movement of multiple people in three dimensions as a way of writing something down to know what happened. So can you tell me how it's traditionally been done? And then there must be things that are being developed.
Well, actually, there is really, there's only a couple of different ways that dance notation has occurred historically. Right now, I mean, now we use mostly video for archival purposes. But before there was video, there were two different notation systems that were primarily used. One is called Benesch, and that was used more in Europe. And what we have had here was called Laban notation, which is the system. I am not an expert in dance notation. I do something called movement analysis, which uses the same symbols. But I have had, when I was in a ballet company, I have had a ballet set on me with Laban notation, and it's unbelievably detailed. And it comes at movement from a completely global perspective, rather than saying, okay, now we're going to talk about this position. You know, in ballet, you might have something that's called first position, and the Laban notation would talk about maybe where the legs were in terms of the three dimensions in space. So we work from a vertical, sagittal, and horizontal dimension. And then we have 27 landmarks in space that we use that are based, okay, this is where it gets a little deep. It gets a little deep because we use crystalline forms. The dimensions are inside of an octahedron. Then we have these diagonal poles that are inside of a giant cube, and then we have something inside of an icosahedron that's made of three planes. And those points in space are our reference points. And then to top that off, we have body parts that have symbols. And then we have dynamics similar to music that, you know, you might have piano and forte. We have strong and light and quick and sustained. And we have different dynamics that we layer on top of the movement.
Whoa.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, holy cats. Being a dancer,
I had
like,
no, you know, I really had no idea.
Well, that was a conversation stopper.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really incredible. I mean, yeah, someone sitting in an audience, they are not appreciating what's going behind the scenes.
Now, let me just tell you, most dancers do not know this system. They learn from a different vocabulary. They learn from a vocabulary, you know, of steps and positions. This is a way of archiving movement. And it gets even deeper because when you're writing it down, you have a staff that's like a musical staff, except for it's vertical and you read from the bottom to the top. And the length of the symbol indicates how much time it takes up.
So how do you do that then? I mean, because you're talking like as a choreographer, I mean, are you like doing this, physically doing the steps and then stopping and writing them down, or?
Oh, well, not me. No, they have somebody, a Laba notator. A Laba notator is a really specialized skill. And yeah. I know when I had this set on me, my experience with Laba notation where I had it set on me, I know that the notator would come over and give us a position or a step. And then she would go back and look at her book. And then she would come back and she would give us some minute correction, adjustment to that step that she saw in that detailed writing. So it is very, very detailed. So what what this is, you know, what this is for, I mean, it's not like the dancer would write it down, but the Laba notator would be trained to come and set this on. And then, yes, I guess a notator would be the one that writes down the choreography. It's very complicated.
Who wants that job?
Yeah. A lot of people are really, I mean, a lot of people love that, you know, and I think that this goes toward a more analytical and a really specialized eye.
Robin, I know this crosses over into your life.
Yeah.
With dance and music and all that. Wow. Have you seen a score where it goes up and down like that? I mean, with her notation?
I've heard of this in legend.
Okay.
Now, most of my, I have had a couple of previous academic appointments that involved working directly with inside dance schools of the music courses dancers take. So, no, primarily that's been an orientation to modern dance, though somewhat with ballet. I have seen some choreographers actually stand in a rehearsal with their dancers holding a musical score before, which is quite remarkable to me to be able to have an understanding of my art form, you know, at an expertise level to know how to interpret that symbolic set of symbols and also possess the choreographic skills as well. Now, I think one thing should be mentioned is that in comparison to music, it's what genre, what aesthetic, what history of music are we talking about? Because, you know, there's the classical sensibilities, right, where things are often notated very specifically. But that's a very different work method than, say, a small group jazz, combo jazz would mm-hmm. create music by, or rock or pop or many other traditions. So just to make one point is that when we speak of music in terms of notation, I think we think of the classical background. And that's where composer and performer are very differentiated roles. Mm-hmm. And most of the creative work of designing the music, the sound, mm-hmm. is done in advance of performers having any contact with that work of art. It's sort of the composer does the work, notates it down, and then hands it off to performers. And my observation, particularly through modern dance, so I think it's more expansive than that, is that often the performers are much more like in a jazz music situation where they're much more involved from the genesis of the work. There may be someone designated a choreographer, just like there may be a leader to the jazz combo, but there's a lot more interaction and trying out of things on the people involved and a lot more blurring of that line between creator and the person executing that is analogous, I think, between modern dance and jazz practices. And then there's also, you know, when Cynthia was speaking of, you know, recording things and, you know, there's still going to be a long time before there's a phone or laptop with a hard drive adequate to the needs of a choreographer, because, man, do they fill up per minute the video of all those rehearsals and all those interactions. But in some ways, that's analogous, I think, to studio technique, that a rock or a pop musician will often work ideas out in the studio where they're recording drafts over and over, and then they're listening back and seeing what they like from that draft. And I think in some ways that's how I've observed choreographers often work, is they do a lot of just trying things out, as if Beethoven doodling at the piano, but they're trying things out in studio and then looking at footage after the fact to sort of cull the best of what's there to take the next step. So like I said, I think there's a piece of different musical traditions that are analogous to the dance world in different, if limited, ways.
And, you know, I poke fun at this, but Julia, math is everywhere. I mean, this is so much math. And as a math person, sometimes we forget the creative ways you can use that knowledge.
Definitely. And I mean, this is something we definitely try to instill in our students in the classroom, that truly math is, and you know, I say it's the language of all science, but really it's a universal language. And look at what we're seeing Cynthia describing, this notation that I'm now very intrigued by, this Laba notation. I am very familiar with musical scores. I've been in choirs for majority of my life, and I have performed like in high school productions, but I have an appreciation for the stage and for performers. But wow, I have a very new intrigue into this notation that is really underlying dance. This is incredible, because I teach like a multidimensional mathematics course at IUPUI, where students are understanding vectors and three-dimensional space and different surfaces. And, you know, it's teaching your mind to think in a new way. And, you know, this is a great new thing I can explain to my students, that look at this really interesting application of three-coordinate space into dance. This is exciting.
Yeah, I was thinking, Julia, that the whole idea that we get confused about with math is we only think of it as numbers, numerals.
Yeah, sure. No,
addition and, you know, those properties. But what we're talking about here is not numbers. I mean, there are counts to both music and dance, but that isn't the big thing here. It is where the position is.
And spatial relations. And
the same idea of notation to describe how long you hold something, like a note. So numbers themselves aren't as adequate as a visual symbol may be, or right, a coordinate in space. So Julia, I think this is really interesting, because for our listeners, I think we're expanding this idea of what math is.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm thinking to myself, okay, so are they assigning coordinates to the different limbs or the center of mass of the person, and how, what plane that person is in? And yes, are they notating this also on the stage floor at the beginning with the rehearsals, so the, you know, there's no crash or collision of these dancers? And it's incredible. And of course, mathematics can do this for you, because you can calculate a center of mass, you can calculate coordinates and translocations, and, you know, all throughout three space, and boom, together with your Laba notation person, you can create some amazing movement, it sounds like.
I'll take a
on my own capacities and training to guess that perhaps Julia could confirm this or not, that the most intriguing parts maybe of the world of math for a mathematician are the things that don't add up. And I say that in the context of, you know, that often within any performative art form, I'll just speak to music, the work will inevitably have an architecture where there's a lot of symmetries, there's a lot of rational, logical ways to add things up. But it's often the things that don't seem to add up that really make for the experience to be intriguing. As a rather well-known composer once said, not long before he passed away, that I was present for, Stephen Alpert, he said, "I have analyzed Johannes Brahms down to the very measure, to the very note, and I still have no idea what it's about." And, you know, so I think we often set up through craft and through technique and through the known sort of a musical architecture that's very elegantly logical. But it's the things that go bump in the night, the things that don't add up within that music. When we do veer off the course, that's when we find it quite interesting. Just like if you go to a movie, if it's predictably predictable, then that's not going to hold much intrigue for someone, as so much as you've got your feet on the ground. You've got an understanding of what's going on, but yet there are things that you don't easily intellectually are able to comprehend. And that's where the curiosity, I think, is sparked. But that was a very long question for Julia, I think.
Yeah. I wanted to ask Cynthia about that then, though. For dancers, is the unknown a bad thing? I mean, don't you want everybody to know exactly where the space, where they're going to be on the stage, where the steps are, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's you know, this can be used as a creative tool, not only as an archival tool. I use it a lot to generate movement because it has a broad base. I mean, if I say, okay, now I want everybody to, for example, give me a movement with a mid-limb initiation in the vertical plane, and I want it to be strong, quick, and direct. They have a whole bunch of different ways of interpreting that. Mm-hmm. And so it comes up with all of these different movement ideas. And what's really interesting is you can see what your movement preferences are when you have this. So if you have somebody that never moves, say, in their sagittal dimension backwards, because that's a very awkward place, you can point that out. You see what your preference is so that you can expand your palette so that you don't just go into your preferences all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very good to generate creative movement and for improvisation. And it isn't, I mean, I think that when it's used for archival purposes, it is very specific, but it also can be very broad based.
Yeah, it makes so much sense, Cynthia. And you know, what I'm wondering with all three of you, what you've been talking about is this idea of collisions happening, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in music, collisions in space, and seriously, a collision with dancers. And that's not something that you want to do very often. I mean, there can be creative reasons to do some, but you really, again, you want to control that. And so I think what's really interesting when I start thinking about somebody in 3D and then I add another person moving, you don't want to just exact, you may when you're practicing, but you don't want to exactly say, just move wherever you want.
Like, no.
Because they're going to hit each other.
Well, we have the whole Laban notation or the whole Laban system is based on what we call the kinesphere, which is the circle around your body that you move in. And so your kinesphere is something, it's like your aura, like your bubble. And it doesn't mean that you can't see what's going on around you, you know, but you're still working within your center space. It's really not something that travels you, you travel, but it goes with you. Mm-hmm. So, if you guys took your arms straight up, like, so everybody take you guys, okay, now I can see you and we'll just describe this to our listeners. So if you took your arms straight up, you know, if we're right here, okay, now you're in your vertical dimension. Now, if you take your arms slightly side, now we're in our, that's too far, Julia. Now you have two spatial poles. This one's one spatial pole. Now you have two spatial poles. You have up and side. So that's your vertical plane. But if we take it here, take it to the forward. So now you got to be up a little bit. No, keep it up a little bit, Mark, right? Right. That's your sagittal plane. So you have, you know, so all of these places in space are very specific. And, and if you took your arm up and side and then forward, that's three spatial poles. So you have a diagonal. And each one of those places in space has a theory behind it, has a character and an idea about how many spatial poles and whether it's mobile or whether it's stable.
I'm going to have to tell my students or have them do this exercise because, you know, there's rectangular coordinates and then there's spherical coordinates and there's different angles depending on. So like if you're looking at the vertical and the angle with the vertical versus which, you know, if you're in the XY plane, there's another angle that dictates in that direction.
Oh, how
so I'm going to have to mention to them this bubble that the dancers are in and help them to visualize this as well. Yeah. This is neat.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really interesting, but it is all based in Platonic solids. That's Laban, Rudolf von Laban, who made this up. I mean, actually, the reason he made this up was that he felt, you know, he was around about 100 years ago, his time, even a little bit more now. But he wanted this to be something like that families did, you know, where a family would learn the upper, you know, sort of the upper class would learn the piano and they would sing after dinner and that was their entertainment. And he wanted everybody to learn these symbols so they could read a dance and they could all have a little movement together after dinner. So,
movement for the common man.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. That was exactly his idea, Mark, was movement for the common man, that it should not be an elitist pursuit. It should be something that everyone.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, we are deep in the depths of the art and science of mathematics and dance right now, and we are going to take a quick break and then be back with more, so please stay tuned.
WICR Christmas Countdown. Check out our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages for fun, interactive posts to celebrate the holiday season every day leading up to Christmas. Share your pictures showing how you're enjoying the holiday festivities and listening to WICR. Use the hashtag ChristmasWithWICR. Photos submitted by December 24th may be included in our holiday collage on Christmas Day. Share your pictures and be sure to use the hashtag ChristmasWithWICR. Happy holidays from WICR.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Well, welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're pursuing the art and science of mathematics and dance with Professors Julia Arciero and Cynthia Pratt and Robin Cox. And Robin, I wanted to bring in this thought that I was forming in my head and see if it makes any sense. But I would think that in the music world, particularly now in some of the ones where we use digital and we have sound in multiple locations, but I would think that there is a three-dimensionality to the sound envelope or to what we're hearing. Would that be true?
Sure. Sort of the most basic equivalency would be the fact that how important it is to have your sound system, at least in stereo, that without stereo, without a slight time differentiation within the signals as they pass to your two ears, or one of the two ears, that we lose a lot. And that we lose a lot of clarity, and that the arrangement of orchestras and choirs and the formation of venue presentation spaces has long accounted for sort of more than just one single direct signal to what, for better or for worse, is we have two points of entry for that sound, binaural. You know, there's two ears, and in many ways that's to our advantage, but it's hard to negate that advantage too. So at the most basic level, that's why stereo reproduction is so ubiquitous and has been for so very long. And in a modern technology mixing session, in the engineering of a recording, that would be called panning, where you move an instrument or move a sound element to the left ear or more to the right ear. And that often, let's say it's just a basic rock band, four piece, you would have each of those so that a certain degree of the sound is directed towards the left speaker or the right speaker. So there's the illusion of them existing in a three-dimensional space.
Robin, that means that any recording then is somewhat choreographed.
Oh, certainly. There's a sound stage in the sense, and that's spoken of virtually as much as it is in a literal sense. There's a sound stage. And, you know, it gets to the point where I remember back in my undergrad, there was a rather well-known French horn faculty at that university who was in the Chicago Symphony for a long time. Well, he sat at the back. So his stereo system at home was wired backwards because he heard everything from a backwards stereo perspective in that regard. So he was used to hearing the classics with the opposite orientations. I thought, well, that's a very refined understanding of a given piece. I'm not sure I'll ever get there. But for him, it was disconcerting to hear it in any other way. So, and you can certainly move sound dynamically during a piece, or you know, not just have it in a fixed location. But there's a tremendous oral difference in being attentive to that or not.
Wow.
You know, when Cynthia was talking about some of these theories and things, and Julia, you started to talk about these similar theories with this space and that kind of thing. What are those used for then? Obviously, we're discovering these elements of math being used in dance and music. What are some other areas that similar, these theories are, what are they and what are they used in?
Well, I mean, if I think about my own research, when you think of coordinate space, right? So I do a lot of modeling of math in biology and medicine. And so one might think, well, what does that have to do with, you know, the space that these dancers are spacing in? Well, you could think about the fact that you might be modeling something in not just assuming like one dimension, one space of blood flow, but you might be looking at it in three dimensions. So you have blood flowing and you have cells interacting and you have forces along the walls of the vessels. So I look a lot at blood flow in vessels and regulation of it, but you have to consider, you know, three dimensions in many cases. And so we have what are called partial differential equation models, which means basically that everything in your model depends on not just time, but also all three dimensions of space. Or you could pick, depending on what you're modeling, you might need three dimensions, or you might just need one or two. And it makes it certainly simpler if you're in one and two dimension. But these are like basic elements of understanding the space and context of what you're trying to model in order to make an appropriate, you know, approximation to your system. And so just having that, you know, having a student understand, okay, space and time, and okay, whether we assume something's well mixed or we assume, okay, actually, if something's happening in one corner, it's different from the other corner of the gut or some place you're modeling. So the dimension is everywhere, honestly.
Ah, and then how do the numbers come in on something like that?
Well, so you always have to quantify. So again, I'm kind of going back to my research just as a concrete example. But so if I'm looking at flow through a vessel, and I have to quantify how big the vessel is. So am I dealing with an artery, an arterial, or a capillary or venule? It's a very different scales. And so, and you have to parameterize your model, because eventually what you're trying to do is replicate what you would see in the body or in a mouse or whatever species you're studying. So certainly, yeah, parameter estimation, getting actual values, then you can solve these equations based on the dimension of, you know, how big is your vessel? How long is your vessel? What types of flows are you experiencing? What types of pressure? So you have to have, you know, actual values in order to model it too.
So this is really similar both to Robin and Cynthia's, in that you both are dealing also with different spaces, or like you say, Robin, you use the word vessels, but things have to be both sound in terms of music and in terms of movement of bodies have to be, you know, I guess, what, designed to the space.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, when Cynthia was talking earlier, I got to thinking about, she had mentioned something about this Laban notator might notice something when they're notating what they're watching and suggest, oh, this person should move, you know, however many degrees or however they're gonna notate that to the choreographer. And I was thinking, well, that's really interesting. So it's in a sense, a mathematician using their skill and saying, okay, look, they were kind of out of the plane, or it would look better in this way to adjust a dance or to make it look more, I don't know, precise. And the same thing happens in my research all the time, where I'm collaborating with clinicians or experimentalists, and I'm using a math model trying to, you know, foundational mechanistic or, you know, principles of physics and math to understand blood flow. And I give some results or simulations or ideas to the clinician. And then they look at it from a different way. Like, oh, you know, we didn't think about it from that perspective. And so now it's like the math is then guiding, oh, maybe we should try this or guide or design a new experiment to account for that, which they might not have seen had they not been collaborating with the mathematician.
One thing that speaks to orientation of sound in relationship, and I've particularly seen this in relationship to dance productions, is that a lot of venues, particularly the larger it is, will likely have what's called a flown sound system, where the speakers will be well above the stage, sort of pointed at an angle down towards the audience. But that becomes problematic for how far removed it is in orientation to where the visual elements of presentation are. And I think this is not very often understood or appreciated, but I think when you have the sound coming from such a different visual, a different orientation in the space from where the visuals are, it's hard to integrate those two things, which I think speaks to the validity and relevance of what we're talking about. In other words, I've tried, usually without success, to ask for sound systems to be behind at the same visual plane level as the dancers, or at least to their sides, but at the same height. Because if they're significantly removed from where you're looking, it's hard to add those two things as integrated as you might wish. You know, I've even brought my own speakers to certain productions and said, I want these at the back of the stage or behind the stage, because I think it makes for a much tighter means to be able to add these two mediums together.
Yeah, and Cynthia, at what point then do you incorporate that music element in with the step element when you're teaching dance then?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're, you know, I mean, what you're doing. If you're doing a classical ballet, the music is, as Robin said, you read the music score too.
Yeah.
You read the music score and you see what happens, and or like a really highly trained more classical choreographer might do that. The music's there right from the beginning. You know, it's right there. It's right there from the beginning. So it's and the counts are incorporated into the notation, I believe. Yeah.
You're also touching, Robin, on something that I think is really interesting here, and it has a physics component as well as math, and that's time and space. And so, I mean, you're really touching on that in that the visual element is in a different time frame than just enough than where the sound element is, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah. Now, just to get down to a practical matter of how important I think this can be, I think dancers can look less energetic and slower by perception, not by reality, but perception on stage, if they react to the music as opposed to anticipate the music. Because from a dance performer's perspective, I think they're using the music to propel themselves. Mm-hmm. But if we've already heard that musical element and they react off of it, they're inevitably after. So I've often encouraged dance performers to anticipate and know the music well enough to hit their mark or to come off their mark at the moment you're going to hear the sound, not as a reaction to that. Because I think even at the microsecond level, things add up differently, or they don't add up because of that.
So interesting, because I'm used to singing in a choir, and it's very easy for your large choir to be not together if you're not watching the stick, right? Because what you're hearing is different from, you know, what's actually going on. And so as a singer, you definitely have to be with the conductor and the stick and not, you know, be biased by what is going on around you. That's interesting to hear it from the dance perspective.
But I also think that has dictated some of how choral literature has tended to be written. It's written to the advantages and away from the disadvantages of that format. And a disadvantage are these very tight alignments of lots of different sound sources. So you often find more sustained, longer sounds, particularly if it's meant for community choir. I mean, look back at the idea of chorales. These tend to be written in very simple, slow-moving changes of pitch and melody, because those microseconds of differentiation don't matter as much as if it was a highly percussive or highly rhythmic style of music.
Interesting.
And it makes me think too, Robin, you know, as we're talking about all this and the importance of the count and the beat, and being able to do whatever you want, like with jazz musicians, how there's always like a point in the performance where they kind of go around and everybody gets to throw in their own sound and everything. But yet that same beat is there. Nobody's ever completely off.
Well,
just enough.
To the potential provocation of a certain segment of the musical world, I do believe it's worth noting drummers are often there for musical benefit. But they're also often there for practicality.
Exactly. They have a very important role.
In other words, they are holding people together. And I think sometimes it can be to the expense of a musical experience that mm-hmm. that they're there to hold everyone together. So it's not purely an artistic function that they're being asked to provide in that respect.
Exactly. I mean, there are many instruments that is their job in a band, is to hold the whole band together that way, where people don't really think about that. They just, a lot of people just listen and hear and like, oh, I love that sound. And I love the way that bass player plays and what he does. Well, his job is actually very important. And the same with the drummer.
So you're repeating the same thing, Cynthia, I know, in the idea of beat.
Mm-hmm.
So the dancer has to internalize, don't they? That drummer. In other words, they have to have a sense of the count.
Well, in traditional dance, yes. I mean, yeah. I think in more contemporary dance, they use music is used more as an atmospheric element than it is as a beat or a rhythm. But yeah, but in more traditional dance, yes, more, you know, ballet and sort of classical modern, and I think that, and certainly jazz dance, yes, absolutely.
I often, when teaching young, less experienced choreographers, I'll often, you know, ask them, you know, the presence of this music, are you, you know, what are the functions of it as you're seeing it? Could one of them be that it's a safety net? Be careful of that. Are you using it as security? And, you know, think of the ramifications if that's one of your reasons for the choices, because it keeps everyone together or keeps everyone sort of strictly in time. And, you know, even if you choose to use it for that purpose, I think it's good to at least be aware that may be why it's that choice of music in that dance. It's there because it suddenly, you know, keeps everyone on track. And it's at least good to be aware of that practicality mm-hmm. function, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, Cynthia, I was watching with my children at the very end, you know, Santa comes on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, but the float prior were the Rockettes. And my daughter was so amazed by just the precision. So I was wondering if you could speak a minute to that type of precision from a choreographer's point of view.
Well, now the Rockettes, you know, they've been doing this for a long time and they have this down to a science. And I mean, they do it, I think, similar to a marching band. Mm. They have a grid that they work with on the stage, and then they have an exact angle of the leg, and they have, I mean, it's very, very, very precise. Yeah, I would say like a marching band has a similar thing going on too. You know, okay. That precision, unison kind of stuff.
But you know what, this reminds me so much, Cynthia, of that wonderful performance piece that you did several years ago along Pogue's Run, where how many dancers did you have and how many things did you have going on? I mean, talk about precision numbers, and it was a sensational experience for people. For those who didn't see it, can you describe that for us and how you put that together?
Well, you know, that was that series of movement choirs that I did with the Streamlines project for the National Science Foundation project. That was a really interesting 4-year experience. And I used all of the Butler Ballet dancers, which is, I'd say, about 120 at any given time. And we created the movement in the studio. We only did it out in the space. Just, I think we had one rehearsal and then one run. But they know, I mean, of course, dancers are trained in a way that they fill in. You might give them a structure and then they sort of fill it in themselves. But we did, you know, I was really happy about the success of that. That's for sure. That it, you know, that it worked. It was a really big experiment, though. It wasn't something that we were going to have really knowledge of how that was going to turn out when we went down there.
Well, and what were you experimenting, and what did you learn from it, and how have you used that information since then?
Well, I think that one of the things that we were experimenting with was, you know, what it's like to work in a site. Like, it was certainly a site-specific dance, and we were working in that big bowl that was by Pogues Run, and so how the dancers fit into the space. How it was, you know, Robin, you were talking about how the sound fits into the space, but how the dancers fit into the space, and that the space becomes part of the dance and part of it. I love working in unconventional spaces, you know, off of the proscenium stage, so that you can have a different idea of a stage picture. And so I think that we really learned a lot. The year before that, we did one at the Holcomb Gardens, down by the canal, and that was a completely different perspective, because that has a different site that we're working with and different elements in the environment that we would be working with. So so I think that was probably one of the big takeaways from that, is working with these alternate spaces.
And do you have plans to do that again, or have you used what you found from those two performances since then?
Well, I think that we probably will one day. I think we have to wait for COVID to pass, because you know, those are really, people are really gathered together and they're working in unison. I did one years ago that had 500 people in it in the Butler football field. But I really have a real fascination for large group works. And those are very satisfying to me.
Maybe post-COVID will inspire the three of you to work together on a math.
Oh, yeah. And that'd be great.
Graphic piece. It would be really great.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. Well, yeah. We're talking about the art and science of mathematics with Cynthia and Julia and Robin. And we want to remind everybody that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls, so that artists, scientists, and the community can all come together for unique activities and conversations. That's what we're doing. We're going to take a break, and we will be back with more.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Dave Bagdad, host of the Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hi, I'm Jason Wild. Join me and my partner in crime, The Todd, every Saturday night for a blast from the past here on 88.7 The Diamond. You don't often hear a show on public radio featuring 80s and 90s music, but we play more than the 50 songs you'll hear on that classic hit station doing an 80s 90s weekend. We dig up obscure songs and tunes that were hits back in the day that aren't heard on radio anymore. Well, that is, until we play them. It's not just about the songs either, it's about the memories and stories that go with them. So tune into a blast from the past every Saturday night at 10 right here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're talking about the art and science of mathematics in dance with our guests, Julie Arciero, Cynthia Pratt, and Robin Cox. And, you know, what's curious to me about all this, and we said it earlier, is how much mathematics beyond the idea of number is involved in so many of the things that we do in the arts. You know, I learned all those spatial things when I was learning sculpture or when I was learning to paint. And we forget, I think, Julia, don't we, that we really literally are using math, even though somewhere along the way we learned that only it was number in school and we didn't like it.
Yeah,
I can speak to that. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, watching my children, you know, my daughter's in kindergarten, watching how she learns, it's really an interesting process because there's so much you take for granted. And then also hearing people, you know, I say this a lot, but, you know, when people hear I'm in mathematics, they're like, oh, well, I hated math in high school, or that's just kind of their response. And I like that we're on, you know, we're having this discussion today and hopefully communicating to students and people out there that ultimately in your math class, you're learning a way to think. And it's that way of thinking that really just sculpts every aspect of your life. I mean, it doesn't have to be that you're going down a mathematician's road, but you're using those techniques, you're using that understanding, that processing, the spatial aspect. There's so much to mathematics beyond just doing some, you know, algebra equations on a paper. That's training your brain in so many ways and reaching out to so many disciplines. And so, you know, you might get a group of, I don't know, you could have a group of engineers and a group of dance and musicians thinking they have nothing in common. But in reality, what we're showing here today is there's a lot in common and a lot of understanding that both people need to have. And I think it's really amazing and beautiful. And I think communicating that to students throughout their, you know, throughout their life, throughout their schooling is important so that the students are encouraged and excited about all the ways they're learning and what it's good for.
I agree. I mean, that's one of the things that it's so frustrating the older you get and when you do learn all these things. Cooking, baking, winemaking is all math and science. But it wasn't, you know, math and science wasn't taught using those elements. So immediately math just turned me off because I thought it was all about numbers and stuff. But hearing all these discussions, you know, the last thing I would have ever thought was something in my mind, very black and white as mathematics blended with the creativity and ingenuity of dance and music.
Definitely.
Robin?
I have a topic to bring up at the very last second here. I'm surprised we've escaped to this point.
Okay.
And that is the division of twos and threes. That within, if anything unites dance and music as art forms, I think it's how we treat divisions of time and not just as what one would think of as dance counts, which may be thought of as analogous to, say, a phrase of music, a certain number of cycles of music strung together that has a beginning, middle, and end, like the length of a melody. But then you get down to the next division, and that is the cycle of beats. Like if you're a musician, you know what 4-4, 3-4, or 6-8 mean. 1-2-3-4. One, where after every fourth accentuation point with regularity, there's added strength, okay? But I think the most interesting part that definitely matters to us all, even though I think it's not as at the tip of one's brain that we are doing it, is in understanding what's called the subdivision of the beat. Now, dances and music are often in certain stylistic categories by not just the beat, but it's that subdivision. And if you try to dance a dance to music that's divided by thirds between beats, but it's actually divided in half by twos between beats, you're gonna have a very hard time. In other words, the difference between say 4-4 and 6-8, 4-4 is 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and with the and being the halfway point between the two beats. 6-8, 1-E-2-E-A. I mean, you can use whatever syllable you want, but it's 1-2-3-2-2-3. And I'll tell you, if I want to make a dancer's life very difficult, then I will substitute one for the other. In other words, if they're trying to think in divisions of two per beat versus divisions of three, it's fundamentally almost impossible to fight between those two. There's just a basic tension there. And it's there in almost any piece of music that we know of any genre, style, or style, or period.
Wow.
So I didn't know if Cynthia wanted to pick up on or validate or invalidate what I just said.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I quite got what you said.
Well, just that if you had a dancer try to dance as if in 4/4, so dut, 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 and I played music, ba, 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 I think it would be very hard to keep your bearings, your orientation to the music, if that beat is divided in thirds versus in half within the regular cycle of what's going on.
Within the regular cycle. So how's that different than a waltz?
Well, a waltz would be at the beat level. One, two. I mean, the waltz is actually at the subdivision level by half. One and two and three and one and. I'm talking about the division of twos or threes, not at the beat level, but the subdivision of the beat. So one, two, three, two, two, three, one, two, three, two, two, three, as opposed to one and two and one and, where at the end is the subdivision.
Okay, no. Okay, so this is just showing my ignorance, but are you talking about something like a hemiola?
Well, it would be if you had the two competing against each other. I'm talking about...
What is a hemiola, folks, for those of us who are... Well,
it sounds like something I get in medical terms.
I know, it sounds like a cardiac condition, but it's two against three would be the most direct way to speak, that you have an element of division by half against some other musical element going on at the same time that's by thirds. So you get this tension between the two elements.
And it seems like, does this happen a lot in more kind of more modern music? I've seen where they change the key signature or things like that, or not the key signature, the time signature.
Tchaikovsky is huge on hemiolas. I mean, you know, and like in Nutcracker, there's like a billion. I mean, it's like a lovely one. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and then it's 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, but it's still in the count.
Mm-hmm. In the first half of the 20th century, with someone like Stravinsky, played along with so that you had different beat patterns without cycles. It's just one after another, and they shift, which is very unusual for how we normally structure this sort of the foundational aspect of time in music.
So this is really interesting, because what you're all talking about here also is the way in which the brain then interprets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Expecting something, and then
in the case of a musician, Robin, sometimes I think it is even hard to change when the conductor changes the beat like that, for a musician.
Absolutely. Yes.
And because there's a rhythm that the brain picks up.
Right. Well, that's the whole point of it. The time signature is a regularity of something. It's the commonality of it happening.
Right. And so I think our brain wants us to do that, to do it, and all of a sudden somebody goes, "What happened?" You know, it's changed. And particularly, I know, yeah, I was going to mention, I've worked with students on doing animation. And when you animate a character, it was so much what you were describing, Cynthia. You do have this halo around an animated character, and you pull and push on dimensional forces within it to make it look real. And I think what's really interesting is, and I always thought this was true in dance, you can have earthbound dancers if they don't move realistically. In other words, if they don't leave the ground and come back down intentionally, they look like they're plodding, and so do animated characters.
I was thinking about all this too when you're talking about the changing of beats, and I was visualizing the Nutcracker and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
As a dancer, it might be crazy, but visually, it's really stimulating and it's very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that kind of. I know that in a lot of, well, certainly in Tchaikovsky's work, those hemiolas are sort of at a climax where you have sort of this rhythm, and then all of a sudden it has this push.
Right, Sugar Plum Fairy, right? Pop, 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 pop.
Yeah.
Dot, 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 dot. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That hesitation, that suspension, it's adding that the mood to the whole piece.
Robin, and one other thing I wanted to ask you, in the world that you work in with modern kinds of music, where, you know, you're creating sounds and things, all of those instruments you're using that are digital instruments are all mathematically based.
Oh, sure.
They're actually based in numbers, aren't they? I mean, the musicians.
Zeros and ones, man. Yeah. An unbelievable number of zeros and ones. Yes. the way synthesis is designed is through which frequencies are more in play than others. And so all that is based very mathematically, with a great deal of mathematical precision. And then it's all converted into digital form. So absolutely, everything, you know, in other words, if you want to be a hardware or software designer in this day and age, boy, you better be good at your math. Because it's all going to come in or out of zeros and ones and proportions of those eventually. Yes.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes left. For each of you, did you guys all learn something new today too? Well, I know Mark and I did. And how can you share that with your students? Because you have an opportunity here to share with others.
Yeah, I mean, definitely from the math perspective, you know, I get to teach a lot of different types of students, whether they're looking to be a math degree or an engineer or a doctor. I teach calc for life sciences, all different types of students. And so, just always trying to show them how and where this is useful. And the fact that mathematics, you have to be able to kind of communicate in different disciplines. So, okay, if you understand something from a mathematical perspective, but you want to communicate to the biologist or the clinician what you're trying to do, or in this case, you want to communicate to the dancer, it's kind of learning to take your foundation and apply it to that discipline. And so, you know, showing and using this example in the classroom is going to be great. And it's perfect for Math 171 for my students out there, thinking about three space and dimension. And now they could talk to a dancer and really get a new appreciation for what plane they're in and how they're moving and what angles they're doing it and why. And so just seeing that connection to the humanities, which is something that a lot of students don't think about, the arts and music. They don't always think about that connection when they're sitting in all their math and science and engineering classes. I think it's great. It's a great way to gain perspective for these students.
Yeah, well, and we really appreciate the three of you guys being here. And Cynthia, we hope we get out of COVID and we can see another beautiful site-specific dance. Yeah. So. We do. We want to thank Butler University Dance Professor Cynthia Pratt, IUPUI Mathematics Professor Julia Arciera, and musician, composer, educator Robin Cox. Thank you all for being our guests today.
And you're going to find pictures and videos as well of their projects and those of other guests on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until our next conversation, I am Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.